Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
First of all, just an announcement so we don't lose it in the shuffle of the afternoon. When you're finished with the session this afternoon, please take your personal belongings with you, or at least get them to a place where you know exactly where they are. We're going to slightly reconfigure the room for the evening session. It's not going to be a big deal. The big chairs on the walls will remain as they are, but the seats in the middle are going to take a slightly different form. So, word to the wise. Okay. Do we have Andrew out there? There you are. Will you give us some music? Not too dark. Gentle. Thank you. The caravan resumes its slow trek across the desert. So this afternoon I want to look at this alleged Gurdjieffian pessimism, which would seem to follow naturally out of the hypothesis that man is a machine, that he does nothing, that everything happens that it's all done to him. So if that's the case, if that's the bottom line, it leaves us some questions. Why didn't he give up? Why didn't he simply fall into cynicism? And as was recommended to Job, curse the world and die. What kept him hanging in? And hang in he did. For 30 years, once displaced west from the Central Asian culture in which he really had his nexus and his cultural reference points, he gets catapulted further and further west to more and more sort of alien and unbalanced societies, landing finally, having made his way safely through two world wars, in the absolutely dying remnants of Western European salon culture, where you get together and have lectures and talk about things and ponder them. And here he comes like a wild turkey who's landed in a flock of tame canaries, trying to bring a teaching. For 30 years he tries different methodologies. How do you deliver them? How do you find a key that will unlock this alien psyche to him? And he kept tinkering with teaching, from great schools to very, very small groups in the 1930s. Within teaching, what's the method? What gets to people? What actually changes something? It was a question that he was experimenting with right up to the end of his life. And along with it, he also shifted gears and wrote. And it's kind of funny that someone who thinks that people are incapable of hearing will create a 1,200-page tome. And that's only the first of the three series. it's like this urge and desire to communicate something. And in a kind of way, for me, the most telltale symbol in the whole thing is the setup in Beelzebub's tales. The whole thing is a conversation with his grandson. And I remember being moved by George Bennett, J.G.'s son, who's teaching elementary schoolers up in up in a corner of central Massachusetts, who was the first to notice this. He says that Gurdjieff first unfolds his teaching to a child, that the first explanations are to a child with the implication of continuance and forbearance. So certainly the sense that the planet was over or beyond salvaging, while it may come thundering through his words, is certainly not reinforced in his being. His being says exactly the opposite, that there's something here that's so precious that you need to keep returning to the place and trying again. So that's the situation in which we find ourselves, and we're going to take a second pass and look at how luminously he held that post during the last years of his life, and the legacy that still remains from that in the teaching, certain aspects of it anyway. But I want, through that apparent paradox, to dive in now on an aspect of the teaching, which I think is actually the chiastic heart of the work and of his teaching and of his motivation. And it's not frequently commented on, or at least not as frequently commented on as, you know, as it might be. And that is the whole question of conscience, or more particularly, objective conscience, as he calls it, as the transforming force that might just turn something around. So I want to spend some time this afternoon sitting closely with some core teachings on what he has to say about conscience and why this is so crucial to a deeper sense of hope that the whole thing isn't completely gone by at this point. There is a place to begin. And to make clear from the start that before you can even begin to get into this subject, you have to distinguish between conscience and morality. Or as Morris Nickel will describe it in his teachings and the commentaries, between real conscience and acquired conscience. So whether we call it acquired conscience or morality, it's not the thing we're talking about. And the first step in beginning to have this conversation is to dispense with that notion. That in polite society, we can't often tell them apart. Because morality or acquired conscience is specific to the cultural conditioning of a particular era or a particular set. It's what Ken Wilber would call a lower left phenomenon. It's subjectively seeded into a particular society, and therefore we'll have some diversity. You know, in just really simply in the Asian cultures from which Gurdjieff came, it was perfectly acceptable to have a mistress, or many of them, for a god. But you must not mistreat your wife. That she must always be honored and dignified, and the real crime is to dishonor your wife in the process of spending time with your mistress. Well, now that's absolutely upside down from what us Westerners would say. You know, you can't have a mistress, that's off the table. And of course, if you're a woman, you don't even get in the ballpark as a slut. But yeah, you can abuse and mistreat your wife and nobody will think anything of it. You know, it changes. You're in certain societies, and to bring the thing much closer to our own political culture, where to say all lives matter would be a statement of affirmation about the human condition. But in certain segments of the culture, it's a red flag that this person is a racist and is therefore seen as an injurious and hurtful and therefore a violation against compassion. Acquired conscience. You know? Does the body really get generically ill from eating pork or from eating fish on a Friday? If you've been indoctrinated that by your culture. Okay, you get what I mean. So acquired conscience belongs to the realm of what Gurdjieff would call the sphere of personality. It's the things that are not really naturally in us and don't correspond to any objective resonance in other worlds. They belong to the temporalities of this world, and we can feel pretty guilty about them, you know, but it's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is something which so manifestly reverberates from worlds beyond our own and is so intuitively and instinctively recognized by all sane human beings as as true and as universally binding, that it claims your heart. So this is what we're talking about, and Gurdjieff insists that this is true and that it is objective, impartial, and that we do have the capacity to resonate with that. As a matter of fact, at the essence of the Asiana Shemash story, we have just this. The whole thing is a little, prolepsis, as they call it, a really dense, laser-like cameo of the entire teaching. And the story goes that well, damn, the planets wandered off track again. And here we go, and we're getting lost in increasing Babylonian wiseacreage, and people are, behaving in the way that they always do when they slip in a matter unbecoming to three-brained creatures, as the language of it goes. So Asiana Shemash is sent to investigate. And you all read yesterday, who were in the reading group, the profound and in some ways, hilarious purgation he goes through to get clarity of discernment in line. But he comes up with the stunning insight, which is almost, if you had to put Gurdjieffian hope in one sentence, it's that the quality, the connection to objective conscience has not entirely atrophied in the human being. It can still be resurrected. It can still be reached. And working through this capacity, that it's possible to restore, reframe, restructure, not only one's personal life, but one's societal order. And the whole Asiana Shemash is a textbook story. It's Gurdjieff's own little legomenism of coming, seeing the root of the problem, seeing that there's hope there, and then taking the steps that Asiana Shemash did, which we'll read about in the reading group tonight, to create a force, a web, if you want to call it that, that would insinuate new behavioral patterns and new societal patterns into a whole culture. It's a beautiful tale. And it's very interestingly, I just kind of laughed and said, what else is new, as I walked in here on Saturday night to join the tail end of the preparatory group that had already been reading this, and found myself face to face with the passage on conscience that we're going to be reading and pondering together. It's like, okay, we better pay attention. This is so stunningly true. And talking with Amy afterwards, she says, I've never heard that implication in there either. It was like there was a teaching that leaped out here. So this is what I want to look at. But as a run up on it, though, I want to start with the obligolian strivings, which you may have encountered draped in various places around the mansion, But the one in question is right over the dinner bell, which I thought was wonderful, the food, the real food. And the strivings were essentially the characteristics and the characteristic orientations of a being who is basically orientated rightly, who's not wasting his or her human existence in sleep, but is endeavoring to grow into the obligations of responsible belonging in this great planetary system. So he lists five. And I'll read this. I should say from advance that my own copy of this is the revised edition that the Foundation put together. And so we can correlate pages. Probably those of you that are working here, as most of the Bennett line does, and most of the Gurdjieff lines do, with the original version, you probably know already what page in your version the obligolian and strivings are. So anyone who wants to read along there, just tell me what page it's on. It's 352 in the new edition. You probably know them from memory anyway. So, all the beings of that planet then began to work in order to have in their consciousness this divine function of genuine conscience. And for this purpose, as everywhere else in the universe, they transubstantiated in themselves what are called the being obligolian strivings, of which there are five, mainly. The first striving, to have in one's ordinary being existence everything satisfying and really necessary for the planetary body. The second striving, to have a constant and unflagging, instinctive need to perfect oneself in the sense of being. Third, the conscious striving to know ever more and more about the laws of world creation and world maintenance. The fourth, the striving from the beginning of one's existence to pay as quickly as possible for one's arising in individuality, in order afterwards to be free to lighten as much as possible the sorrow of our common father. Well, there it is. Boom. All of a sudden, things shift a whole level. Up to this point, the three strivings have talked about things that almost anybody could think about as taking on if I was a spiritual seeker wanting to better my life and lot to self-realize. Well, yeah, of course. Thank you for the permission to be rich and comfortable in my physical being. Not all religious paths will let me, but this one will. To get everything you need for your physical body, get it, you're allowed to do that. Okay, good. Then, the striving, the really urgent, insisting striving to perfect yourself in the sense of being. Well, sounds good. A worthy project. The third, to learn all you can about the law of three and the law of seven, the basic rules that run the planet. So you can actually cooperate and learn here responsibly. Not just getting squashed in the system, but actually being able to have some means to affect situations. Okay, we're still working roughly in the ballpark of personal mastery, right? Very 1980s. But then, the striving from the beginning of one's existence, from the ever-present origin, to pay as quickly as possible for one's arising in individuality. One must pay. In order afterward to be free to lighten as much as possible the sorrow of our common father. And if that in any sense shifts the whole attention, center of your attention, toward your heart, it's accomplished. It's doing. To sense all of a sudden in here that there isn't just take, there's pay. Mm-hmm. That this came at a cost. That this came at a huge cost, both horizontally and vertically. That we know that there is a cost of our arising as we arise from the blood, sweat, and marrow of our parents and our context, and are supported, as we read in the Bennett Grace, by the continuing recycling of death of living things that other living things might live. We know that. But this idea of the sorrow of our common Father, what is this anyway? But it brings in a whole new note and color. And if you're sensitive in your being, you've noticed that we've just had a level shift here. And then from there, we flow out into the final striving to assist the most rapid perfecting of other beings, both those similar to oneself and those of other forms, up to the degree of the sacred Markvatai, that is, up to the degree of self-individuality. In other words, out of that eye of the needle flows what you might call the bodhisattva nature of the fifth striving. That it is to aid in the assistance of other beings, not to keep it for yourself, but to flow out again. But notice that the arrangement of these five strivings is not in any sense psychically random. You couldn't just reverse the pieces of them and have the same teaching. It goes through this eye of the heart in the fourth striving, where you're brought up short with the sorrow of our common Father. The language is shockingly personal, shockingly relational, a point that we're not going to let go of till the end of the session or till the end of the time together, but we're not going to be hitting it with a bludgeon either. Just note. And then through that, in some sense, arousing of pity for our common Father and a willingness to help cosmically in the cost of anything's arising. From there, we flow out into the compassion for others. It's a very interesting arc in these things, a very compelling arc. So, with that as a backdrop, and with the question of, well, what's all this about the sorrow of our common Father? We shift to the passage that I walked in on the first night I was haplessly here. And someone said, oh, why don't you come to the Beelzebub breathing? We're talking about objective conscience in this passage. Well then, it was to those very same great initiates who were first set apart that the very saintly, now most saintly, Ashiata Shiamash, then explained in detail, among other things, what this being impulse of objective conscience is, and how factors for its manifestation arise in the presence of three-brain beings. In other words, what's the origin of objective conscience in us? If we actually still have the seeds of it or the embers of it glowing in it, where does it come from? What is its nature? And here begins this absolutely astonishing teaching. Concerning this, he once said of the following: the factors for the being impulse of objective conscience arise in three-brain beings from the localization in their presence of particles of the emanations of the sorrow of our all-loving and long-suffering endless Creator. That is why the source of manifestations of genuine conscience in three-centered beings is sometimes called the representative of the Creator. You hear what he just said there? That it arises, the factors for the being impulse of objective conscience arise in three-brain beings from the localization in their presence of particles of the emanations of sorrow. Particles of the emanations of sorrow from our all-loving and long-suffering endless Creator. You know, we've been running around like drunken idiots trying to drink into our body these emanations that arise from the sun, from the most holy absolute to coat our being bodies. And, but what the seeds of objective conscience lie in the sorrow of our Creator, of our common Father, of our God. And this is where, this is the origin of objective conscience in us. The tears of God, if you want to put it in metaphoric form.
Do you mind reading that one more time, that line?
Certainly. The factors for the being impulse of objective conscience arise in three buried beings from the localization in their presence of particles of the emanations of the sorrow of our all-loving and long-suffering endless Creator. That is why the source of manifestation of genuine conscience in three brain beings is sometimes called the representative of the Creator. In other words, it's the viceroy, the divine receptor planted in our own being, consisting of nothing else but the sorrow of the divine. So, you know, this says it goes back way, 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 way into the bowels of the manifested at all. But to note that it has its origins, this impulse that can change us, that can save us, that can turn its way around, has its origin in the suffering of God. Okay? So that's enough to wrap your head around for things. And now this next one, and this is going to be a tight Mobius loop of the teaching, the next point. And this sorrow is formed in our all-maintaining common Father from the struggle constantly proceeding in the universe between joy and sorrow. So, remember this morning we were with Teilhard and he was looking out at the universe, the blue ball, the green ball, and then the black of the suffering, and the struggle, the balance between joy and sorrow. And it's the struggle between the two of these that caused suffering to our Father. So why not just be a divine Father and do a fet and say, okay, to hell with all sorrow, we're just going to do joy. Let's get rid of the darkness, just let there be light. Why not do that? Well, the third paragraph goes on to say, he said, Father, in all the three-centered beings of our entire universe, without exception, including us men, owing to the data crystallized in our common presence for engendering in us the divine impulse of conscience, all of us, and the whole of our essence in its very foundations are and must be only suffering. So we're into a kind of funny loop here. First of all, he's saying suffering is ineradicable in human beings, he's saying. And basically, because it is the absolutely necessary conditions for the awakening of conscience, authentic conscience. And we're going to see how awakened conscience is really the drive shaft of everything, the drive shaft of evolution, the drive shaft of emergence. But you're not going to take away suffering even from God, because it's part and parcel of the continuing engendering of this holy being impetus. So he's going to go on and explain this a little bit further in the next paragraph. Consequently, and we must be suffering, he says, because this being impulse can come to its full manifestation in us only through the constant struggle between two quite opposite complexes of functioning, issuing from two sources of quite opposite origin, namely between the processes of the functioning of our planetary body and the parallel processes of the functionings arising progressively from the coding and perfecting of our higher being bodies within the planetary body of ours, which processes in their totality actualize every kind of reason in three center beings. So the struggle goes on because this being impulse of conscience can come to its fruition, can really be born only in the struggle between what you might call the higher impulses and the lower impulses of us. And he explains that he pictures them in a very, very interesting way in this paragraph. That there is struggle not between virtue, right and wrong, morality, you know. There is struggle between the desires of the planetary body, which is for its own, you know, satisfaction, you know, comfort, endurance, and the needs and the desires of our higher being bodies, Kesjan, and so on, which essentially will, once crystallized, begin to confer upon us agency, individuality, identity in realms just beyond this one, so that we can really serve as bridges and transmissions and liminal conductors between the realms. So in the struggle between these two apparently and really phenomenally, experientially tasted struggles between what we used to call our ideals and our desires, that so much of all spirituality is with, between the flesh and the spirit is another way that this has classically been pictured. It's in the struggle that the being impulse is released. The birth, you know, that's the crucible of the emergence of authentic conscience. And one of the interesting things in the way he pictures it, not as just using the old language of the struggle between flesh and spirit, is that he sees it as the struggle between a higher and a lower, or a service in one realm as opposed to a service in another. He sees it as a struggle between two levels in ourself, not between two warring ontologies, substances. But he goes on then. Consequently, like all three-centered beings of our great universe, we men existing on the earth, owing to the presence in us also of the factors for engendering the divine impulse of objective conscience, must always inevitably struggle with the two quite opposite functionings arising and proceeding in our common presence, the results of which are always sensed by us either as desires or non-desires. In other words, do we satisfy our desires, or do we, in some sense, discipline them, transcend them, sacrifice them? This is universal spiritual truth. You know, if you've ever worked in the Tibetan Buddhist practice, you know, when you look at, I got to paint one year when we were in wisdom school at a Buddhist center in Scotland. I got to paint the angry dragon of craving. You know, these things that just suck us back, and you know, and it's going to be this way, he says. It's going to be this way. We are going to be caught for as long as we live here in the struggle between impulses in us emanating from fundamentally different orders of being and possibility. What we might call in the old language, you know, desire and the sacrifice of desire. Not my will, but thine be done, O Lord. You know, this is all turf you're familiar with. The only thing you're not familiar with, perhaps, is the kind of slightly tangential language he's putting to this. And then he draws the conclusion of this. And so, only he who consciously assists the process of this inner struggle and consciously assists the non-desires to prevail over the desires behaves in accordance with the being of our common Father Creator himself, whereas he who consciously assists the contrary only increases his sorrow. His, incidentally, being capital H, the sorrow of our common Father. So we've come full circle on this Mobius loop. If you want to relieve the suffering of our common Father, if you want to help, it is in the continuous and courageous embracing of the struggle as it plays out between you, in you, in every breath, some of the teachings would say, between the higher order impulses and the lower order impulses, or the higher order desires and the lower order desires. The desires which are going to lead to the satisfaction of your sense of self and being at this level, but are going to increase the darkness, the drama, the confusion, the suffering of our common Father. Or to participate as much as we can in any moment in the honest taking on, the acknowledgement of the conflict and doing the best we can as it presents itself with any moment with the conflict between these desires. And to the extent that we gain some measure of distance, you know, control is not exactly the right word, but equanimity, mastery, so they're not dragging us around. To that extent, we are able to place into the planet the final fruits of a conscience that works in that direction, which will be a greater lightness, a greater equanimity, a greater spaciousness, a greater letting be. And that substance that is generated through our own sacrifice lightens the suffering of our common Father, while at the same time deepening in our own self the connection with the wellsprings of authentic, objective conscience. For Gurdjieff, this amounts to the awakening of a deeper capacity. What would inspire us to do this? Because we all know that the struggle between the higher and lower is not an easy one. I mean, the struggle with sinful self-will, the struggle with the desires, the struggle with, yes, struggle to stay present on the movement's floor, the struggle to not give in to the drama of your life is never easy. It's much more comfortable to float downstream on the broad, steady river of attraction and aversion, telling yourself, what a good fellow you are, and how you're entitled to this, because the planet was so unfair. So what in us could awaken something that could catapult this beyond the realm of enlightened egotism? It's easy, you know, relatively easy to struggle with yourself if you know that you're going to get something out of it at the end, right? You know, hey, you know, it may be a struggle now, but I get my Keshen body, I get my astral body, I get my permanent individuality, you know, it's the old, yeah, so great, why not? You know, I'll put up with a little, but ultimately that kind of motivation won't stand. Because the terrible irony of this whole thing is that you can only fall through that last vestige of enlightened egotism by the rising up in you of a greater force, of what he calls elsewhere, and I think more powerfully, remorse. Some people would like to call it love, but love is too sweet for most of the occasions. Most of us can no more love than we can click our heels together and fly back to Kansas. But the place where it can be awakened, and this fourth obligoldian striving is for me an eye of the needle of it, is can you feel outside yourself remorse for God? For our common Father, remorse for the price that's been paid for your arising, remorse for the carelessness, for the entitlement, for the sleep, for the selfishness, for the unconsciousness. And remorse not as a statement about, oh, I failed, you know, that collapses at a whole thing, but as a deeply authentic impulse that's grounded in PTA, pity for another being, the delicacy, the fragility, the cost born in your own heart. That's the direction that he keeps pointing us to. If you can find it there. And for Gurdjieff, as for a few other teachers, including the Cloud of Unknowing, that sense of remorse is really the starting point for the rebuilding. Because you've finally gotten to the bottom of the crap, the excuses, the lies, the self-justifications, and understood in a deep way. And remorse is not a capacity of the mind. Period. It will always immediately default to guilt. Remorse is a capacity, really, of the feeling come to fruition in some sort of balance. And it is for Gurdjieff in a very profound way the gateway into objective, into connection with the higher, particularly the higher emotional center. So it's a very sacred quality. When he talks about the sacred don't just think this is a funny name. Hearing it, the whale. The whale of the river of sadness that has been created in our planetary existence, and that originally goes back to God, that, you know, the whole thing becomes a completely self-canceling object that in order to wake up people, you have to suffer, you have to limit, you have to, you know, there has to be struggle so that this thing can wake up, which is the springboard to the fulfillment, the fullness of love. And love without, you know, love founded on something that doesn't dig so deep into personal collective sorrow is always going to be glib. It won't hold. So, you know, the terror of the situation is that, in a sense, it has to be as it has to be. And every vibrating quark of the manifest and the unmanifest universes bear a part of this as the cost that anything can be at all. And in general, to the extent that you bear it consciously and willingly and with this paschal sense of paying back into the whole, it will serve to lighten the sorrow. To the extent that we get caught in our own drama, it will just deepen the confusion, the slide, precipitous slide toward the hell realms. So to look at that teaching, which is again, it does not say anything that isn't said in all the great sacred traditions in their own language. But it says it in a way that is so sort of slightly out of left field, away from the usual kind of associative chains that we put on it, that you may hear it freshly. This is where the inner work on yourself, the struggle with self that has so dominated the teaching and training practice platforms of the work in work groups, inevitably connects with and finds its own heart. Because this work, finally, of the struggle with yourself, the work on yourself, is in the context with and on behalf of the collective. It's never about you. It's never about coding your particular angel wings in whatever realm you aspire to, because they're all going to dump you back the same chute. You know, you think it's any more fun in the imaginal realm? Mm-mm. You know, the services become more and more intense, more and more all-embracing. This is the easy realm. So there it is. But and it's a note that's frequently missed in the work. You will miss it if you're just reading in a reading group. Because the heart has to be awakened before you see it. But once you see it, you see that what holds Gurdjieff in the post is his deep sense of the work for the collective, which is ultimately the work, his share, of relieving, you know, bearing a part of the suffering, the sorrow of our common father. So the dimension, once the heart opens through remorse, clarifies the inescapably collective nature of the work, which in turn softens it and takes it away from a bunch of dirds trying to perfect their own being into a dynamo, you know, a turbine for the placing into the planet of a quality that had gone almost dark. And it's interesting to be considering that right where we are at this point in time, the election coming up, the COVID, you know, ramping up again all over the country, that it really seems like a winnowing time. And if we look at what human beings have been putting into the planet, heavy duty, particularly since the end of World War II. It's been entitlement and drama, whining, my victimization, my rationalization, my need, my rights as a being. Nothing has been said for a long time about accountability, about obligation. We don't like that language because we're only used to hearing it in Victorian traffics, where it immediately thinks, well, I don't get to be myself because I have to do all this damn stuff. But when you put it in the heart, it has a whole different resonance to it. It has the resonance of the people here who get up in the morning when they don't have to and see that the coffee wants to be made so that those that sleep later find a coffee pot. It comes in the spontaneous noticing of when something is missing and putting the piece in. The staying present with the tasks that need to be done, not out of a sense of, oh, now I'm going to get my brownie points, but because the whole will be happier when this is done. So it's done out of a spirit of generosity and gift. And it's these qualities that soften and change the planet. And I think this is what we're at the end of an era of entitlement which has reached its nadir, I hope. And something is calling us back to a different sense of what it means to be a human being. And the people in the evolutionary movement have been talking about this for some time now, but they talk about it in hyperbole. They're like, oh, we're coming onward and upward. Consciousness, we're in the next transfiguration. We're next to the harbinger. You have to enter, says Gurdjieff, through the gate of remorse. It's the only thing that will keep it pure, open the hearts, and finally meld the heart. And once again, please, 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 remorse is not guilt. You didn't do anything bad. Well, you probably did, but everybody does, you know. Forgiveness is part of the turf.
Yeah.
It swims in mercy. It's met with gentleness. So it's not in a juridical atmosphere. It's in an atmosphere of exchange where it's a universal. Remorse is you're waking up to the fact that there is a universal burden contracted. And you have a piece of it, whether you like it or not, because you're here. And it's a saying, I'm going to carry that. I'm going to carry that for God. I'm going to carry that for all sorts of things. That's the possibility. And that, I think, is what kept G.I. Gurdjieff in his post and why, despite the sort of outer language of pessimism and cynicism, what got generated in those groups, particularly in that final decade in Paris during the war, during the occupation, was of such exquisite fineness that those who came into its proximity, who sat around the dinner tables for the long free-form teachings that he finally fell into giving toward the end he backed away from the precise expositions of, you know, points of metaphysical truth that had characterized the early year. People gathered, they assembled, they sprawled before him. And when he saw they were unhappy, he fed them, or he took them out on car rides when he could, you know, to let them be in a different relationship with themselves and with others. He did everything to simply nurture what was there before him. He bought art, schlock art, you know, terrible art from his neighbors, because he didn't want to give them charity. He wanted them to be able to earn, you know, because their pride told them, you know, I can't take charity, but I can sell them a picture. So he bought this crap, you know. In every sort of way, he was propping up and giving to human beings. And when he talks in the web exercise about is possible to warm the city of Paris, that's what I sense him doing. Those that touched him in the right frame were touched by that, and one who did it was J.G. Bennett, who met Gurdjieff early, then went away for a couple of decades, you know, not entirely for his own choice, and then came back at the end, and was one of those that sat around the table in the last decades and caught something of the heart of the man, the ancient man, as he neared the end of his human life. And I think it's that spirit that more than anything else in the Bennett line has made it in a sense the most creative and supple survivor of the lines of the work. The one most open to receptivity, to new ideas, to new approaches, to new possibilities, new mutations. I think it comes from something that Bennett had in his being to begin with, but what he really caught, he caught the heart of the transmission. So I thought I'd read, just to conclude, as we begin to segue toward the evening session, a little bit that some of you may have come upon already in my Eye of the Heart book, where in the chapter about the conscious circle of humanity, I talk about how the functions of this, the conscious circle, with regard to the planet and the planetary situation you find yourself in, are basically what I call cosmic dialysis, or in a sense to purify the environment, you know, to take this constant stench of drama and heaviness and terror and you know, self-possessiveness and greed that just gets generated by human beings who've lost touch with their deeper moorings, and to breathe it in. And to, in the ways that we're capable of, place in the atmosphere the fruits of that transformed work that comes from our own conscious work, offered back to relieve the sorrow of our common Father, to do that work, to offer calmness, steadiness, equanimity, non-judgment into a planet which is teetering on the edge of a collective psychotic break. It has always been the work of wisdom, conscious circles, and it's our work still, how we find it. I mention the work of the transmission of wisdom, the streams that go underground, the knowledge, not the pop programs and slogans. But finally, I talk about how this kind of work, rightly construed and rightly orientated, can actually participate in delivering third force into a situation where something changes, which, while it looks like calamity on the outside, something shifts the planetary situation and essentially disaster is avoided. And there have been times throughout history where this happens. Gurdjieff speaks a lot about this, and I'll talk more about this again on Saturday. But as part of it, there's times that these little groups, consciously constellated, doing this work, can be part of a component where things sort of miraculously shift around you. So I listed a couple of examples, one which Murat Yegin, my teacher, told me about about the decision in Central Asia to attach Sufism to Islam. that basically warded off destruction of a whole culture in Central Asia. I looked at the transposition, the swatting of the whole Tibetan Buddhist tradition west, occasioned by the catastrophe of the Chinese invasion of Tibet, but it proved to re-inseminate the whole planet with a teaching that needed to go outward. And then I looked as my third example at this chapter. It's called Is Paris Burning? My third story may be my own fantasy, but only the last connection, all the rest up to that point, is verifiably true. During the dark days of World War II, when most spiritual teachers were fleeing for refuge to less war-torn places, Gurdjieff elected to stay put in Paris, in his tiny flat, less than a quarter of a mile as the crow flies, from the central command post of the German occupation. And in this bitter season of deprivation and hopelessness, he set about generating intentionally the energy of abundance, the missing element in a desperately traumatized world. Using skills he had gained who knows how, he managed to acquire huge stockpiles of food, not just basic staples, always available in an unlocked pantry, but elegant luxuries, Armagnac and chocolates, served up in lavish banquets in an atmosphere suffused with the limitless possibility of the human spirit. Those who still remember those banquets know full well that the real food being served was love. At Babette's feast, not of literary creation, but carved in real-time flesh and blood. Just over the hill, in the Place de la Concorde, during the summer of 1944, the noose was tightening on the Nazi occupation. The American troops had landed in Normandy and were steadily making their way toward Paris. An elaborate scheme had been set in place by those leading the German evacuation that would have left behind a swath of destruction, obliterating some of the great monuments of human culture. Dietrich von Koltz, a general widely known for his ruthlessness, was in charge of the operations. Explosives had been placed under Notre Dame Cathedral and the Louvre. It's all detailed in the book, Is Paris Burning? Somehow it never happened. The reasons are still not clear. There was never a moment when it was decided not to blow up Paris. There were negotiations and communications right up to the end, but no moment of decision. Like the tide turning, the moment simply receded. I could never prove that there was a connection between these two events, but knowing how imaginal causality works, and Gurdjieff's skills in this realm, I cannot not believe it. In my heart, I still fiercely hold it as his greatest gift to our West. And I offer up my prayers of gratitude. I will count him forever among the 36, the 36 conscious human beings on which, according to the old Hasidic tale, the safety and continued survival of our planet depends. So I think of that this evening. And I think of those exercises that so many of us are now getting our teeth into. And I think of the dates of them. The web exercise was given on May 25th, 1944, in one of those sessions, Paris group meeting. At that point, just before the invasion, the atmosphere exercise came on August 3rd, 1944, 3 weeks before the troops rolled into Paris. So all of history was rolling at the time, these things that we now want to take as our sort of timeless truth were being generated on the spot in conditions of danger and deprivation by someone holding the ground and weaving the energy field around him by the magnetic center of his conscience and the centrifugal field of his love. So may we be so worthy to at least make a stab of continuance in our own particular time of planetary crisis as the post of the conscious human beings is always being held because it must be. And while you don't know for sure that you're one of them, that's not the point. You do the work. You offer what you can. If one sits and tears apart this final bit of this teaching that I just read on conscience, I think you'll find food there, Lectio Divina style, to encapsulate the work in five paragraphs, but also to contextualize it within the sorrowful bosom of our very personal Creator God, and there find its purity, which finally overcomes your own self-interest and egotism, as it's simply drowned in the immensity of the mercy through which any of this holds together. So I think that as we shift into the evening events, I'm going to ask Andrew if he'll give us another run up through Bukhari and Dervish.
Tonight.
Now. There is no tonight. And let yourself just sort of sink into the through the song to the vastness of the joy and the hope and the possibility that reach us even in the midst of our sorrow and our fear and our confusion and our failures upon failures upon failures. It doesn't matter. Something else reaches. You can't find it?
It's not here. I'm not sure why, but
It's not here. Okay. Well. So we'll do something else then. It's not here. We'll have to wait for it. I like to hear about Gary. Well, the other thing that had occurred that I actually scrawled down and wrote about was that a lot of the same teaching is encapsulated in Quaker teaching. And those of you that know the first album of Paulette with the old Quaker chants, here I think is a run-up on the same teaching. You got it? Okay, we'll do it. We'll do the Quaker teaching later because the music is better if you can do Bukhari and Dervish. I'll show you how the stand still and that which is pure will work. We can do that tomorrow morning or tonight. Okay. Don't ever say that we've pre-planned anything.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, once again, remember to take your belongings as you go. Reading at 5:45 here, per usual. Dinner at 6:15. Back at 8, as we offer the Mass of the World in a context that I'll kind of walk you through as we get here. Just bring your quiet mind, and we'll take it from there. See what the planet meets us with. Thank you all.